It was like shedding the carapace of my childhood, maybe sensing a career path, but certainly connecting up the circuits of my adult emotions and passions. Arnold himself, an extremely rotund figure at this point, seemed, on the face of it, very jolly, and I was delighted to be challenged to play better than I thought I could. Knowing he'd had an important early career as a trumpeter in major London orchestras before turning full-time to composing gave him added authority. As I got to know this symphony, which was having more and more of an effect on me, I think I became ever more in awe of him and couldn't quite summon up the courage to talk to him in the way that our precocious 13-year-old tousle-haired timpanist Simon Rattle could. Simon remembers those weeks in Mödling with the same enthusiasm as me, and Arnold as incredibly helpful. There was certainly no sign of the aggression or nastiness of any kind which, had we known more about Arnold, we might have expected. They were sun-kissed days, and in the morning break, a group of us would wander down to a little roadside kiosk cafe for a coffee. It made me feel better about myself, because I'd had a term at a school in Germany and was doing A-level German. So I did the ordering. It was August. It was hot. The mood in the cafe was laid back and friendly. On the 21st of August, we trotted down there as usual, to be greeted by the sight of all those in the cafe huddled round the radio, pale, drawn faces etched with naked fear. It didn't take me too long to realise why. Overnight, 200,000 Warsaw-packed troops with 2,000 tanks had invaded Czechoslovakia to quell Dubček's Prague Spring. I could remember my parents' unrest when the Cuba Missile Crisis was on and the newspaper billboards blurting out the assassination of JFK, but I'd been much younger, and anyway, that was all safely distant and two-dimensional. Now some vaguely liberal English schoolchildren were confronted with disbelief on the faces of people who knew the Soviet war machine was at that moment only a few miles away across the border. Enough of them remembered what had happened 30 years before to be genuinely terrified that the Russians wouldn't stop at that border. It was the first time I'd seen such powerful emotion about something so unknowable to me. Maybe being confronted with something so real also unlocked some of my adolescent English repression. I felt the same about the emotions in Malcolm Arnold's Second Symphony, be they joy or anguish or anything in between. Arnold behaved impeccably when he was working with us. Those running the course had, I discovered later, a rather less happy experience with him, having to drag him out of a local hostelry to come and take rehearsals. The two behaviours collided in the most public way. A day or so before the final concert, which we were to give in the famous Theater an der Wien, we heard ORF, Austrian television, were coming to film us playing, presumably to sell a few more tickets. The room we used in the school we'd taken over for orchestral rehearsals was full to bursting with all of us players. So the rather strange decision was made to go outside into the field opposite the main entrance. There seemed to be very few naturally flat surfaces in the Vienna woods, and this wasn't one of them. Eventually, we were all set up in the heat and glare, precariously balanced on the slope. We waited until Malcolm finally appeared, and for the first time I'd noticed, he seemed unsteady on his feet. The cameras turned, and as Malcolm was about to give his upbeat, a butterfly fluttered past him. He made a grab for it, fell over, and started rolling down the slope. I laughed, as did others, not because it was funny, though I suppose in a way it was, but out of sheer embarrassment and pity. I was trying to come to terms with the fact that this composer, whose music was having a profound effect on me and whose conducting inspired me, had just proved he was all too human in a very public arena. Maybe it's with the benefit of hindsight, but I think I realised immediately this was not just someone who'd overdone it at lunch. This was someone who needed alcohol to make life bearable. My hero worship had to adjust its parameters. On the day of the concert, we were bussed into the centre of Vienna. I don't know how well we performed Malcolm's Second Symphony. I got far too involved in the music to play my best, not that it probably mattered much halfway back in the second violins. I felt I could understand that in very much the same way as Shostakovich does in his symphonies, Arnold was bearing his soul in this music. Thank you. The styles and colours of Shostakovich and Arnold in their symphonies seem to me to be not so far apart, particularly in the way they portray forced gaiety and bleakness. The difference lies in their backgrounds. For Shostakovich, living in the Stalinist and post-Stalinist Soviet Union, his struggles are more often than not against political and artistic oppression, his innermost personal feelings only emerging on occasion. For Arnold, his symphonies are a way of letting out the extremes of his own emotions bubbling within him in all their complexity, anguish cheek by jowl with ribaldry, fear with anger, joy with despair. The second symphony is relatively short. I find brevity one of Arnold's great strengths. Within a tight time frame, he can still express a kaleidoscope of emotions. In none of his pieces do I feel the sky is cloudless, but then, as Schubert said, music can never be entirely happy. And it's in his symphonies where I would unhesitatingly say Arnold is a great musician, yet another composer who wrote 9 of them. They are no more and no less than an autobiography in sound, and a movingly accessible document which gets to the heart of what we all feel. So why on earth is this music so often damned with faint praise, little performed, and these days almost never by the big orchestras? It's often trotted out that Arnold wrote 132 film scores. Does that mean he can't have composed serious music which doesn't follow an overt storyline? He was at the height of his powers in the 50s, 60s and 70s, when so many critics seemed to sneer at any music that wore its heart anywhere near its sleeve and, heaven forbid, had tunes. Arnold wrote music that anybody wanting to be snootily intellectual could easily take potshots at. Just because music's accessible, why does it have to be less profound, less important? It's whether it works in your ears, head and heart, whether it tells you something about yourself and the human condition that's important. Sometimes the music's really vulgar. I've heard people objecting to that. But then life can be really vulgar. Nothing wrong with that. Then they talk about emotional clichés in the music, to which Arnold himself had the perfect riposte. In times of great emotion, he said, we speak in clichés. When Arnold was asked in a radio interview how much of his private life he put into his music, he answered in a way that would surely have pleased Mahler, who said a symphony should embrace the world, replying simply, everything, one's whole life. By the mid-1980s, Arnold's life was in turmoil. His relationship with his children was at a nadir, and though he could seem reasonably normal in public, the rather over-the-top life and soul of the party, he must have been excruciatingly lonely. A manic depressive alcoholic living in a small room in a pub. A pub, for goodness sake. The couple running the pub threw him out, and friends put him up in a hotel while trying to decide what to do. Mike Purton, a BBC producer who'd made a film about Malcolm, was living in a Norfolk village next door to a man called Anthony Day, who he knew had been a companion to an elderly stockbroker in his final illness, and was perhaps looking for someone to care for. Anthony was interested, went to the hotel where Malcolm was, and when the staff opened the door, found him sitting on the floor in a corner of the room looking absolutely terrified. He was bruised and a mess. Anthony discovered Malcolm was vastly in debt, was told he'd never write music again and would probably live for less than 2 years. He cleared the debts. Malcolm did compose again and lived for 22 years, cared for and given structure to his life. Working for Radio 3 had given me the chance to listen to a lot of music, and I'd realised again how important Arnold's was to me. I discovered he really wasn't well, and wanted to tell him what his music meant to me. The opportunity to visit came in the spring of 2004, when I was conducting Gilbert and Sullivan on tour. A couple of days beforehand, Anthony rang me to say Malcolm had a severe infection and was in hospital in Norwich. I asked whether I could still visit, and was told yes, but to be aware he was off all the drugs which kept his manic depressive illness in check. I wondered what I'd find, and mentioned my nervousness in the green room at the theatre. Mary, one of the choristers, said she'd enjoyed playing some of his music as a young clarinetist and would love to meet him. I was pleased not to be going on my own. Arriving in the hospital, Anthony took us to this shrunken, hunched figure sitting in a chair by his bed. At first, Malcolm thought I was a psychiatrist, and abused me with a mixture of fear and ferocity. The bared, animalistic teeth you see at the end of Tony Palmer's film about him frankly terrified me. I didn't know how to handle it. I had a simple agenda of wanting to thank him for his music, but it didn't look like anything I said would be understood. Anthony was deeply caring but firm, and Malcolm, used to being looked after by him for 2 decades, responded to what he said in an almost childlike way. When Anthony had to go to speak to the doctor, I didn't know what would happen, but Mary took Malcolm's hand and caressed it. That seemed to calm him, though from time to time, without warning, he would suddenly grasp her hand painfully tight, baring his teeth again. I tried to talk about the Vienna Woods and the Second Symphony and the effect it had had on me. I don't think Malcolm had any idea what I was on about. I rather felt I'd fluffed my lines during the visit, and also had the sense that Malcolm had played me like a fish, whether he knew he was doing so or not. I left the hospital feeling chastened. I'd recently listened to his 9th symphony for the first time and knew it was dedicated to Anthony. I asked Anthony later how that came about. He told me that on his birthday in 1986, Malcolm had kept on teasing him about it until he was so fed up he snapped, "Oh, go and write some music, for goodness sake." Malcolm had composed hardly anything for 4 years, so it was a remark made out of pure frustration without any thought it would bear fruit. So Anthony was amazed when Malcolm took himself off and in just 3 weeks of extraordinary creativity, completed the whole 45-minute symphony. The 9th is a portrait, Malcolm said, of the 5 years before Anthony rescued him. It's bleak, resigned and sparse. There's none of the ebullient orchestration of the previous 8 symphonies. Some thought it an impoverished and sad way to end a symphonic cycle, and as Malcolm believed at the time, end his composing life. Yes, he was no longer capable of writing the virtuosic scores he'd reeled off with so much ease. But listening to it, it works with a surreal intensity, much of it a devastating study of dejection and utter loneliness. The last movement is almost 25 minutes long, bare, lunar in its arid landscape, but with finally a feeling of a kind of serenity.
The End of the 9th Symphony by Malcolm Arnold, discussed by today's essayist Martin Handley. And you can hear the whole of Arnold's 2nd Symphony in Essential Classics with Rob Cowan tomorrow morning at around 11:30. In this week's final essay at 11:15 tomorrow night, Sarah Moore Peach talks about a composer who's particularly special to her, Hildegard of Bingen.
On BBC Radio 4.
It was a story that was not comparable to anything at that time.
These people aren't just a bunch of nuts. They're perfectly willing to die for what they're doing.
The kidnapping of the heiress Patty Hearst in 1974 created an unprecedented media circus.
CBS was covering this shootout when they started shooting their guns.
Benjamin Ram speaks to the key figures involved.
It really was the beginning of media obsession with celebrity.
Captive Media, the story of Patty Hearst, on Saturday evening at 8, over on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 13 minutes past 11, and now it's time for Late Junction with Fiona Talkington.
Você inventa, grite, eu invento. Ai, você inventa, chora, eu invento. Você inventa o luxo, eu invento o lixo. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão.
Você inventa, grite, eu invento. Ai, você inventa, chore, eu invento. Ui, você inventa o luxo, eu invento o lixo. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão.
Você inventa a lei e eu invento a obediência. Você inventa Deus e eu invento a fé. Você inventa o trabalho e eu invento as mãos. Você inventa o peso e eu invento as costas. Você inventa outra vida, eu invento a resignação. Você inventa o pecado e eu fico aqui no inferno. Meu Deus, no inferno, valha-me Deus. Você inventa, grite, eu invento. Ai, você inventa, chore, eu invento. Você inventa o luxo, eu invento o lixo. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão.
Você inventa grite, eu invento pai. Você inventa chore, eu invento ui. Você inventa o luxo, eu invento o lixo. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão. Você inventa o amor, eu invento a solidão.
While a Brazilian musician like no other, Tom Zé, you invent luxury, I invent humiliation, you invent love, I invent solitude. Welcome to Late Junction. Collectress is a UK-based collective of multi-instrumentalists whose album Mondegreen is out next week. This is a tune called Owl, featuring Penguin Cafe Orchestra's Arthur Jeffs as guest on prepared piano. That's Collectress and Owl. I like owl-related songs, and that comes from their album Mondegreen. Arthur Jeffs was joining them on that track, and actually I'm going to play something from Penguin Cafe Orchestra later on tonight. Collectress are on at the Vortex in London this Sunday night, Friday the 28th at St John's Church in Bridgetown in Totnes, and Sunday, March the 30th, they're at Little St Peter's in Preston Park in Brighton. Well, yesterday here on Late Junction, I played you a track which featured the guitarist Klaus Busse Ferrari, who I had the great pleasure of meeting in Mannheim last year at the huge Enjoy Jazz Festival. This comes from his solo album Live, and Low Key is the title of the track.
Thank you. whole aisle and scold and filed and rise as old my world is stole wild and every way in style. Old and mild and bold, salvine and styled and coals and marade and time. Mild and aim. Old and my old and my oldest time and guile is old and vile. Never made a stole and style. Mold and vile and old mountains, old and never styled and old as a merry wrinkle mile. All old is that ain't I'll stayed. And make me old is old as mild as a mane of gold.
You know, that's one of the best albums in the world. Christian Valamara, Sissel Enderson and Helga Steen from the superb album Merry Winkle. And I was talking with Christian at his St George's Bristol concert a few weeks ago. And in fact, we did a pre-concert talk together for which he chose music to talk about. And one of his choices was Lully. So next week, I thought it would be fun to feature some of Christian's music alongside Lully. Klaus Busser Ferrari was the guitarist before. That was Low Key from his album Live. And it was very good to hear him live in Mannheim in the autumn. And what a nice person too. Fiona Talkington with you on Late Junction here on BBC Radio 3. The hashtag is Late Junction, by the way, if you want to chat about the music or tell me what you've been listening to. Canadian guitarist Adrian Russo teaming up with Fanfare Ciocalea for a new album called Devil's Tale. And that was the sleazy Erne Street Tavern. Yesterday I played you a very playful piece by John Cage from the new album of early Cage music for tape and electronics by the Langham Research Centre. I really like this track from the album too. It's called Cartridge Music and it's such an elegant sound. Thank you.
See an accident, do not turn your head and look away. I can see detectives are sifting through the wreckage we have made. It starts with only one kiss. It changes. See the man who lost everything. He
And we're back in Nordic noir territory. That's from Martin Huntved's score for the Norwegian TV series Mammon, whose dark story will make it onto UK TV screens this year too. David Byrne's The Accident just before, and John Cage's Cartridge Music featuring on the new album by the Langham Research Centre. Many thanks to Sebastian at London Jazz News for slipping this next CD into my hand. This is the South African Herbie Tsoaeli, music inspired by the soul and soil of Africa, he says, in Hamba no Malume.
Thank you.
James Macmillan's Lux Aeterna, one of his 14, I think, Strathclyde motets. And that was the 16 there, conducted by Harry Christophers, following Hebe Tsoaeli. The 16th Choral Pilgrimage takes them to Cambridge tomorrow night, to St John's College Chapel, and to Oxford on Saturday for Christchurch Cathedral. Randy Tuttenvog is a singer who addresses the grief of miscarrying a child in her beautiful and touching album Lights Out. This track is called Today Was Cancelled.
My today was cancelled. Suddenly I stopped. My feelings ran before me. Catch up. My today was cancelled. I have lost control. I am full of empty. I can't hear my soul. I wish I could switch myself back on again. Will someone tell me who I was back then? My today was cancelled. Thank you.
rather lovely polska, polska after Olaf Löfgren, played by the duo of Anders Tunell and Olaf Luxengård Mielva. Much of the music on that album coming from the Härjedalen region of Sweden, where Anders has lived all his life. They followed Randi Tuttenborg, and Today Was Cancelled. That's from her album Lights Out. Jyotsna Srikant comes from Bangalore. She's a great ambassador for the South Indian classical style of playing, but she's just as happy playing free jazz and folk music. This track, Vanam, is the opening number from her album, Call of Bangalore.
Thank you.
The violinist Jyotsna Srikant with percussionists Pari Satish Kumar and N. Amrut. That was Varnam from her album The Call of Bangalore. The Coen brothers' film Inside Llewyn Davis follows a week in the life of a young folk singer as he makes his way in the Greenwich Village folk scene in 1961. This is one of the songs featured in the film, Ewan McColl's heartfelt The Shoals of Herring.
It was a fine and a pleasant day. Out of Yarmouth Harbour I was fair as a cabin boy on sailing lugger for to hunt the bonny shoals of herring. Well, I earned my keep and I paid my way, and I earned the gear that I was wearing. Sailed a million miles, caught 10 million fishes that we'd hunted in the shoals of heaven. Night and day the seas were daring. Come wind or calm or winter gale, sweating or cold, growing hot, growing old or dying, as we hunt the bonny shoals of herring.
Who else could that be but Penguin Cafe Orchestra? That's Radio Bemba, which comes from their new CD, The Red Book. I know they just finished quite a long tour, but if you want to catch them live, you have to go to Dublin for the 25th of April. That's their next live gig. And they followed on from Ewan McColl and The Shoals of Herring. Played that from a CD of the soundtrack to the Coen brothers' film Inside Llewyn Davis. Well, just before I finish, there's a couple of concerts you might be interested in before I see you again. On Monday at the Union Chapel in London, the Eric Whittaker Choir features Marius Beck as a guest. I played Marius earlier in the week, and he's going to come into the Late Junction studio and sing a couple of songs next week. And also in London, St John Smith Square, the Delta Saxophone Quartet, who've been celebrating 30 years together recently. Their adventurous programme includes Arvo Pärt, a Mark Antony Turnage premiere, Terry Riley, Brian Eno and Steve Reich. That's quite a collection. But I'm going to end tonight here on Late Junction with a track from the new album by Stian Vesterhus. It's not solo guitar, but it's a new project he's put so much work into, and it's made him very, very happy. He's joined by Austin Moen of Jager Jazzist fame on keyboards and drummer Erlen Dahlen, who did a Late Junction session with John Paul Jones for us a while back. And as a trio, they call themselves Pale Horses. Remember that name. The CD is called Maelstrom, and this is Nights and Sleepless Days. Until next Tuesday, good night.
Hello and welcome from me, Jonathan Swain. This is Through the Night here on BBC Radio 3. Alessandro Scarlatti was Domenico's father, best known for his vocal pieces. And among his many oratorios, there are two called La Giudizia. The one we're about to hear, it's libretto written by Cardinal Pietro Ottoboni, first heard in Rome in 1693. A few years on, Scarlatti wrote another La Giudizia to a different libretto for a performance in Cambridge. The story is much the same in both of them. King Nebuchadnezzar sends an army against Israel to demand overdue tributes. His general Holofernes lays siege to the town of Bethulia and is about to conquer it when the young Jewish widow Judith goes to him to implore mercy. He's overcome with love for her and after a banquet falls asleep, at which point Judith beheads him and returns victorious to Bethulia. A few decades on, Vivaldi chose the same subject for his oratorio Judita Triumphans. This performance from Krakow in 2012, Judith and Holofernes, are sung by soprano Roberta Mameli and contralto Marta Fumagalin, and Claudio Cavino conducts La Veneziana.